Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is by Alex Janin. Who should take Alzheimer's blood test? Then Laura Cooper wrote, top brewers bet big on tiny cans of beer. Jim Carlton has an article, beach access penalties turn into epic battle. We'll follow that up with Xavier Martinez, novel breast cancer drugs show promise. Then we have one by Jim Solish, why aren't doctors better with words? And we'll follow that up with one more by Lou Weiss, when your friends all turn 70. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one. Who should take Alzheimer's blood tests? For years, doctors relied only on written memory tests, invasive spinal taps, and expensive imaging to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. Now, two Food and Drug Administration cleared blood tests are simplifying the diagnosis. The tests from manufacturers for GBO Diagnostics and Roche Holdings were cleared last year and look for different versions of TAB, a protein that forms into tangles in the brain and can lead to memory loss. Uropioz test also measures a protein called beta amyloid, which can form sticky plaques that are a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease and a target of recently approved drugs for the condition. These tests, which use different methods and report results in different ways, can help evaluate patients with early signs of cognitive decline, neurologists say, but they are not designed to predict Alzheimer's risk in healthy people. Even if they could, there are no approved treatments to prevent the onset of the disease yet. Until there is a treatment for asymptomatic people, this will probably not be a routine health check, said Dr. Xing Yang, a neurologist at Mass General Brigham and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. There's a tension about more knowledge versus do you really need to know. Whether doctors want people to get these tests or not, the demand is there. Doctors say they are fielding more requests for these tests from healthy, symptom-free patients, many of whom do have a family history of Alzheimer's or dementia. A 2025 survey from the Alzheimer's Association found that 91% of Americans would want to take a simple test, like a blood test, to know if they had the disease. Consumers are increasingly seeking access to and knowledge about their own health. The proliferation of wearable devices, direct-to-consumer testing, and more personalized forms of care, such as concierge medicine, have made it easier to do so. Alzheimer's-related testing, which generally requires a doctor's order, is just one slice of that. A blood test can be a lower cost, less cumbersome option for people with signs of cognitive decline, and these tests may eventually prove helpful for people with a family history of Alzheimer's who want to know more about their risk. Drug makers are also developing medications that target tau tangles in the brain, so patients may have more options in the future. Yang and other neurologists say some healthy patients have already found ways to get the tests and come to them concerned when they see results suggesting signs of Alzheimer's may be present in their brain. He reassures them, noting that many healthy older adults have amyloid buildup, but not all of them develop Alzheimer's disease. Roughly 15% of healthy, symptom-free people have abnormal levels of amyloid in their brain at age 50, according to a 2022 meta-analysis published in JAMA Neurology. By age 75, that number jumps to more than a third of people, and roughly half by age 85. A baseline measure was what 34-year-old Patrick Murray was looking for. When he heard about a study at the Institute for Neurodegenerative Diseases of Florida that was using blood tests to evaluate personalized prevention plans for people with a family history of neurodegenerative diseases, he signed up. There were no red flags in his test results, he said, but he still met with a nurse practitioner trained in preventive neurology in the hopes of optimizing his health. He made several lifestyle changes, including getting more consistent sleep, doing more zone 2 exercise, and eating more salmon for the omega-3 fatty acids. Murray, a father of three who works in finance, plans to repeat the testing in the future to see whether the lifestyle changes made any impact. Trying to do as much as I can to give myself a better chance to continue to live a long and healthy life. Research into whether Alzheimer's tests and treatment can help prevent or delay the disease is accelerating. There is a growing body of evidence supporting behavioral changes to promote brain health, such as eating a healthy diet, not smoking, and limiting alcohol. Pharmaceutical companies are studying whether Alzheimer's drug on sale or in development could also slow or delay the onset of symptoms if given before they appear. Some of these trials are using blood tests to screen participants, making it easier for researchers to find people who qualify. Eli Lilly, as well as partners Biogen and Issei, are studying whether their amyloid-targeting drugs work to prevent the disease. Not going to be reasonable to ask a population of people over 55 to all go and get fancy brain imaging tests and spinal taps, says Jeffrey Kirchner, the global head of neurodegeneration at Roche, which is also planning an Alzheimer's prevention trial for its experimental drug. It's going to be reasonable for them to just get it as part of their general blood work. Researchers are also studying whether finger prick blood samples can pick up Alzheimer's-related signs as reliably as standard blood draws, which could make in-home testing for research a possibility. Early data suggests the samples are promising, but they are not ready for clinical use yet, says Nicholas Ashton, Senior Director of the Fluid Biomedical Biomarker System at Banner Sun Health Research Institute and one of the study investigators. Even in people with symptoms of cognitive decline, positive results on the FDA-cleared tests don't prove that a patient has Alzheimer's disease. Neurologists do caution. Further imaging and testing is required, says Arjun Mazukar, a cognitive neurologist and associate professor at NYU Grossman School of Medicine. The results on both tests can vary subject to daily body fluctuations, such as whether the patient is sick or ill. For the so-called worried well, which could include people with or without a family risk, Masukar recommends getting a baseline evaluation of their brain function, which also often involves getting a brain MRI scan and doing a pencil and paper cognitive test. Insurance coverage for that kind of evaluation is not guaranteed, but the results can serve as a benchmark that doctors can use to track a patient's health in subsequent years. Anything fancier than that is neither supported by evidence more needed, he said. And now, top brewers bet big on tiny cans of beer. America's top brewers see big business in small beers. Sierra Nevada and Modelo maker Constellation brands are among the companies rolling out smaller cans and bottles, known as ponies, and sales are growing, say industry analysts and executives. The beers are taking up residence during the important summer selling season. The week of July 4th is generally a standout for the industry, with beer sales running roughly 37% above average, according to the Beer Institute, a trade group. We're bullish on what ponies can add, said Craig Purser, chief executive of the National Beer Wholesalers Association, which represents more than 3,000 beer and beverage distributors. Consumers do not have to make a 12-ounce decision. Sierra Nevada, which introduced its small can Pils Brew back last fall, quickly found that it was a strong seller. The company, which sells the beer in 8-can packs, has since decided to sell the small cans in packs of 16 in select markets this coming fall. The piece we did not fully appreciate is how the size would appeal more broadly to folks who want to moderate, said Ellie Pressler, Sierra Nevada's chief growth officer. I hear it from fellow parents who want to moderate. They still want a beer at night, but are still parenting their kids, so it allows them to have a treat to themselves. The name Pony dates back to the late 19th century, according to Molson Coors. It is commonly used as a synonym for small. Kegs are a half barrel of beer, while Pony kegs are a quarter barrel, Purser said. Coors is credited with the Jukes introducing the first aluminum can Pony in the late 1950s. Smaller brews are taking on new life now, as many drinkers cut back on their spending and alcohol consumption. The beers range in size from 7 to 9 ounces, smaller than the typical 12 or 16 ounce cans and bottles sold in packs across the United States. They are similar in size to soft drink beers that offer 7.5 ounces of Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and other beverages in mini cans that are growing in popularity. Nick Fink, chief executive of Constellation, said the company has been in the small beer world for more than a decade. "We're leaning into it. I think you'll see extensions into this," Fink said. He added that the use of GLP-1 drugs for weight loss offers an opportunity to expand the utility of small beers and move into little tree culture. Oswaldo de la Garza, who lives in the Tampa, Florida area, is a loyalist of Coronita, a smaller version of the Mexican larger Corona. He keeps his poolside cooler stocked with them. "The little ones are perfect. I take them everywhere, even to a little get-together. They're the perfect size," de la Garza said. De la Garza, 32-year-old, said he has been drinking the 7-ounce beers for about 2 years and does not plan to switch back. His wife, he said, finds them cute. "Generating momentum for any type of product is critical for the beer industry. Through April of this year, domestic beer shipments were down 1.6 compared with the same period in 2025, according to Dana Adelaide by consulting firm Bump Williams. And while there has been sales momentum around smaller container sizes, their share of the beer market does remain small, according to Bump Williams. Earlier this year, Bud Light released a Post Malone-branded limited edition miniature can, pushing the idea that beer in smaller cans stay cold while you drink. Molson Coors has seen its sales of Miller High Life Pony bottles grow steadily over the past 5 years. Constellation is now putting Pacifico into 7-ounce containers after success with Carnitas and Modelitos. About 7 million cases of Carnito are sold each year, according to Constellation. Greg McLeod runs a Florida beverage distribution company and delivers brews to about 3,000 stores. McLeod, president of Pepin Distributing, said he has seen sales of the smaller beers outpace many other beer package sizes. In hot and humid Florida, McLeod said, residents love the smaller container because they can put it on ice and consume it in less time, which means it's always cold. And now, beach access penalties turn into epic battle. This article is from Carlsbad, California. John Levy Jr. built his dream home by a lagoon overlooking the Pacific Ocean and turned it into a private retreat he christened Levyland, complete with its own pickleball court. Then the Coastal Commission came for him. Back in October, the state agency hit the 74-year-old and his associated trust with up to $2.5 million in penalties, alleging he locked a gate to the beach and blocked a trail to a lagoon, among other things. Levy says the gate is not on his land and the trail is private. I'm quite frankly troubled by what I see as a brazen disregard, Commissioner Ray Jackson remarked about Levy during a public hearing, characterizing the situation as a direct affront to the people of California. Levy joined that hearing via Zoom from a second home he has in New Zealand and could barely contain his anger. He accused the agency of spreading falsehoods and sicking activist groups on him, including one represented by a former reality star known as Mitch the Bitch. Now, everyone knows where the rich dude that blocks public access lives, Levy told commissioners as the sun rose behind him. While disputes over California beach access are not uncommon, Levy's ongoing battle is being watched nationally for challenging the Coastal Commission's most potent tool, its authority to impose significant fines. Levy is suing the agency, arguing that its power to levy ruinous financial penalties without proving allegation in court violates its constitutional right to due process. They're the investigator, they're the prosecutor, they're the judge, and they're the jury, said Levy. Few state agencies wield more muscle than the Coastal Commission, which was established back in 1972 to safeguard public shoreline access and has tangled with luminaries, including Hollywood producer David Geffen, who was forced to open access to the beach in front of his then home in Malibu. In 2014, California's legislature gave the agency even more power, permitting it to impose fines up to $11,250 per violation a day. 2 years later, the commission used that authority for the first time by dropping a $4.2 million penalty on a homeowner. Proponents say the commission is all that keeps California's coastline open to the public. Critics argue that it stifles development and inflates costs with heavy-handed, unchecked regulation. Levy grew up surfing in San Diego County, then made his money selling dog collars and other pet producers. Back in 1996, he spotted the land that would become his home in upscale Carlsbad. He built the quintessential bachelor pad, 3,700 square feet with 30-foot ceilings, but just one bedroom. He later married, had two children, and in 2006 moved his family to New Zealand, renting Levy land to guests, some of whom used it for weddings. Neighbor complaints about noise at a wedding led to a wider commission investigation by the Coastal Commission, said Chandra Sladen, a land use consultant for Levy. It sparked a continuing, nearly decade-long fight that centers on two gates. The first, a locked electric gate at Mountain View Drive at the top of Levy's driveway. Though Levy upgraded the gate with local approval when he moved in, it actually sits on land owned by a nearby town home homeowners association, not Levy. He argues he cannot control a gate that isn't on his property. Commission staff disagrees. They say Levy controls the gate and that the current HOA board claimed they were not even aware they owned the land. The HOA then declined to comment further. The second gate raises a different question, whether a footpath on Levy's land on the lagoon's edge is public or private. When Levy built his home, he offered a public access easement as a condition of his permit. But the city of Carlsbad, he argues, never accepted it. Commission staffers counted that an updated city trails map included the easement and that the city staff at the time said the pathway was accepted. But current Carlsbad officials have sided with Levy and have hired outside counsel to challenge the commission's claim. Back in 2017, the commission ordered Levy to open the gates or pay daily penalties of up to that $11,250. When threats didn't work, the commission in 2024 slapped Levy with a cease and desist order, which started the process of full-blown enforcement. Advocates rallied on both sides. The Pacific Legal Foundation, a national public interest law firm, is supporting Levy. Through public records requests, Levy's team discovered the commission had alerted environmentalists and others. Commission officials said they waged no such campaign. Levy has agreed, under protest, to open the electronic gate in return for the commission's reducing its fine by $1.1 million to $1.4 million, secured by a lien on his home. This is straight up extortion, what they're doing to me, Levy said later. His lawsuit does continue. Lisa Hogg, the enforcement chief, said 90% of the time, the commission is able to settle such cases without fines. We do not care about the money, she said. It's a deterrent to try and protect public access. Now, novel breast cancers show promise. Drug companies have found new options for one of the most aggressive and hardest to treat forms of breast cancer after decades with few breakthroughs. Gilead Sciences won Food and Drug Administration recently to sell its drug Trodelvy as a first treatment for newly diagnosed patients with advanced form of a type of breast cancer known as triple negative, because it has characteristics that render common treatments relatively ineffective. It is the second recent approval. AstraZeneca and Daiichi Sankyo's rival drug, Datroway, was approved for a similar group of patients back in May. Both of the drugs are antibody drug conjugates, a type of targeted therapy that uses an antibody to identify a protein found on most triple-negative tumor cells, and then delivers a concentrated dose of the chemotherapy directly into the cancer. The aim is to spare more healthy tissue than standard chemotherapy, which attacks growing cells throughout the body. These drugs both reduce the risk of progression of the disease by around 40% when compared with standard chemo. The process is a lot more palpable right now and bringing us a greater deal of hope and excitement, said Dharman Kalpa, a breast medical oncologist at the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center in Miami, who was not involved in either study. Upwards of 48,000 Americans were diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer last year. It is often diagnosed in younger Black and Latino women. Patients with the advanced form of disease live for a median of less than 2 years. The disease speed is why doctors say the first treatment choice matters more than for slower growing cancers. Triple negative breast cancer recurs and spreads after an average of around 2.5 years, compared with 5 years for other breast cancers. About half of patients never get a second type of treatment. Gilead's approval rests on two trials, both measuring how long Trodelvy kept tumors from growing. There is not yet enough data to determine whether the drug extended patients' lives. Trodelvy, when given on its own, cut the risk of tumor progression or death by 38% compared with chemotherapy in patients who were not eligible for immunotherapy. In patients who could take immunotherapy, which represents about 30% of all triple-negative breast cancer patients, a combination of Gilead's drug and Merck's Keytruda cut the risk of tumor progression or death by 35%. AstraZeneca's drug, Datroway, in its own trial against chemotherapy, cut the same risk by 43% and extended median survival by 5 months compared with chemo. AstraZeneca did not test its drug in combination with immunotherapy for this approval. The two drugs have not yet been tested against each other, so doctors can't really say which works better. Analysts expect Datroway's breast cancer sales will top out at $714 million annually, said life sciences firm Norstella. Both of these sales for breast cancer are expected to peak above $2.4 billion. It's really important to have the most active drugs in those early lines of therapy, said Dietmar Berger, Gilead's chief medical officer. Terry Childers learned she had triple negative breast cancer that had spread to her chest and lungs back in 2023. Her doctors told her she would eventually die from the disease, 63-year-old Childers recalled, but that they tried to buy her time. Her oncologist at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center offered to enroll her in Gilead's clinical trial, and she started treatment the following January. That was the only thing I was really offered, said Childers, who was also eligible for immunotherapy. There was no existing medicine that they had that would kill this. By March 2024, her tumors had shrunk. She's since had a mastectomy, 44 rounds of radiation, and a recurrence that sent her back to treatment. Childers drove more than 6 hours from her home in Abilene, Texas, to Houston three times a month until her oncologist arranged for her to get infusions of Trodelvy and Keytruda, the immunotherapy, closer to home. Scans back in May showed Childers' cancer still shrinking. She now spends the days that she's not exhausted by cancer treatment at her grandchildren's baseball games and dance recitals. She says she has not missed one yet. AstraZeneca and Gilead are testing their drugs at earlier stages of the disease, including using their medications to shrink tumors before breast removal surgery in cases where the cancer has not yet spread throughout the body, and the follow-up treatment to clear out any leftover cancer cells before they have a chance to spread. We're seeing this very impressive benefit in the metastatic setting, the Dr. Sarah Tolaney, chief of the breast oncology division at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, who worked on the Gilead trials and was involved in early design of AstraZeneca's. It makes us want to move these drugs into earlier stage disease and try to cure more patients. We do have some more articles today. Why aren't doctors better with words? The other day, a colleague told me she was pregnant and that she was going to her first OBGYN appointment. I congratulated her. She returned to the office looking stricken. You okay? I asked. No, I am not okay. I'm a geriatric pregnancy. That's what I am. I've worked with her for several years, and I knew her age to be 36. Ouch, I said. Turns out the medical profession is not great at marketing. Forget marketing. They're not even good at euphemism or being polite. These folks tell older people that their joints and discs are degenerative. Not to get too philosophical, but everything alive is degenerating. If you're over 50 and have an x-ray taken of your spine, be prepared to be told you have degenerative disc disease, which, according to the Cleveland Clinic, is a condition in which the cushioning in your spine begins to wear away as a natural part of aging, so not actually a disease. When my wife was pregnant, her OBGYN declared her cervix to be incompetent and put her on bed rest. Her reaction? What did you just call my cervix? Nothing about my wife is incompetent, and she was deeply offended. It still stings more than 30 years later. Just so you know, I'm not one for euphemism. I'd say people died when they pass away. I would never call my used car pre-owned. And if our company had layoffs, I would not dare say we were right-sizing. But what we name things matters, especially in a field like medicine where the goal is health. If I had heart problems, I'm not sure I'd be jazzed to make an appointment at a heart failure clinic. The word failure does not imply a continuum. That word would be failing. failing is so final. When you experience battery failure, your car is dead. Teams that fail to win lose. While we're parsing the meaning of words, there is very little wiggle room in the meaning of the word geriatric. It derives from a Greek word for old age. The Oxford English Dictionary defines geriatric as relating to the branch of medicine that deals with the care of people in old age. So what were your doctors thinking when you came up with the term geriatric pregnancy? Geriatric women cannot get pregnant. Were you guys, and this had to be a group of men, trying to be clever, or were you just oblivious? I'm guessing the latter. It's a good thing hospice care already has a name, or you men might call it death watch. I could go on, but I'm running late for a physical therapy appointment for my knee. It's at a place called the Limp In Clinic. And we have When Your Friends All Turn 70. One by one, my classmates from elementary school are turning 70. And the celebrations and acknowledgments are moving through our lives like Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Review. There are low-key affairs in someone's home or a restaurant, not fancy parties or far-flung cruises. We gather in sixes and eights for dinner at places chosen more for their decibels than their desserts. 7:30 reservations? Didn't they have anything at 6? Seating is more ritualistic than a state dinner. Men at one end of the table, women at the other. A couple of middlers sit in between for when conversation includes the whole group. I try to grab the chair to Goldberg's right, as that's his good ear. Entrees are often split by couples and still leave something for tomorrow's lunch. Because we are turning 70 and have license to let loose, we order a single dessert with 6 forks. Discussions range from Steelers Super Bowl at one end of the table to new grandchildren at the other. Both ends have mourned the death of Bill Mazeroski, who recently fell down in another topic followed by my grab bar lecture. The shower, I explained to my friends for the 15th time, is a silent killer. Downsizing and condo strategies are divulged. First floor master bedrooms are the holy grail in hilly Pittsburgh. Our hard drives being full, we can vaguely remember that we had some grudge, but not what it was about or who it was against. We're mostly beyond hating and bragging at this point, happy to be vertical or angled a bit. I'm one of the few still kvetching about rap music and why Saturday Night Live is not funny anymore. I see why parents would name their kid ASAP Rocky, but did they really need the dollar sign? Seems gratuitous. Also, our serious channels keep getting moved. The 40th, which logically used to play on 4, is now up near Sinatra. The 50s and 60s, formerly 5 and 6, are 72 and 73. The 80s, 90s, and 2000s are rightly at 8, 9, and 10, but watch out, 70s on 7, you're hanging by a thread. One fit friend, Wendy, plans a dance party that I was going to miss, so we met over coffee. A trained art conservator, she is the unofficial archivist for our second grade class. She pulled out a Polaroid of the third grade boys. Without hesitation, I named everyone, but stopped short as I realized that we now knew how many of their life stories unfolded. Engineer, doctor, carpet salesman. I still picture people as they were in their prime, not as they are now, which isn't that bad since we came of age right when people decided to get healthy. Our grade was especially lucky, missing both the draft lottery and mullets, but catching erectile dysfunction pills when they went generic. To paraphrase Monty Python, we're not dead yet, but as we meander through our 70-year events, the birth class of 56 is mainly happy to have made it this far, leading productive and meaningful lives and remembering those whose lives whose lives were cut short. The Hebrew blessing on a birthday is that you should live to 120, Moses' age when he died in good shape with all of his marbles. Instead, let's shoot for 80 and see where we go from there. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.